The following is the third in a series of six master class lessons given by Ernest Wilson in August of 1974 at Unity Village.
Philip Wheeler Wilcox wrote, "I gave a beggar of my store of well-earned gold. He spent the shining ore and came again and yet again, still cold and hungry as before. I gave a thought, and through that thought of mine, he found himself, the man supreme, divine, fed, clothed, and crowned with blessings manifold, and now he begs no more." A true spirit, you find the statement in The Great Physician. To spirit, supply is instantaneous. To consciousness, it is progressive. To spirit, supply is instantaneous. To consciousness, it is progressive. This applies in so many different ways. For instance, an artist, in a twinkle of an eye, can get the concept of a beautiful painting, but it takes quite a while to work it out. Dominique Zappia, the famous Kansas City sculptor, whose most important work, The Last Supper, carved in Lindenwood in our Kansas City church, got that concept of the sculpture just a moment. It took him 4 years to do it. Figures are life-size in the round, so realistic you almost forget they're made of wood. Yes, to spirit, results are instantaneous, supply is instantaneous, response is instantaneous. But to consciousness, it takes a little longer. Who was it that said, the difficult can be done immediately, the impossible takes a little longer? Paraphrase of the same idea. So we use supply according to consciousness, that is, progressively. And the law of supply is the law of circulation, of giving and receiving. You've heard the statement often, when things are tight, something has to give. Now you can adapt that too and say, when things are tight, someone has to give. Someone has to give. We have to do something to open channels. And we all know, and we've been taught this, I think, in grade school probably, that if everybody pays their debt, the same dollars can serve 100,000, a million times over and over again just by circulation. Just by circulation. If I owe you a dollar and you owe me a dollar and somebody else owes a dollar, we can pass it around and it'll be the same dollar come back to us. But it's served all those needs. Good circulation produces good health. It's impossible to have as good health as we'd like to without good circulation. Good circulation makes it better. And the law of physical health, you see, in this too, good circulation applies. Good circulation in business. No matter how many good products a merchant may have on his shelves, he's not prosperous until those things circulate. Quite a long while ago, when coffee was difficult to get, at the same time that coffee was difficult for us to get, wheat was scarce in Brazil. And some smart individual had the brilliant idea of supplying wheat to Brazil in exchange for coffee from Brazil. And in doing so, everybody was made that much happier and a little more prosperous as well. Years ago here, there was a Republican convention during my previous incarnation in Kansas City, along in the late 20s and 30s, somewhere in there. And the number of people who came were not quite as great, or was not quite as great, as had been anticipated, and so some of the men who had concessions didn't sell all their products. And there were a lot of felt, gray felt elephants left over. They seemed an utter waste until somebody got the idea of trimming them down a little bit and making democratic donkeys out of them. And that was for the convention that came just a little bit later. Nearly always it's possible somehow to find some way to give, some way to release the infinite supply, because somewhere in the world there's always the supply that's lacking somewhere else. And if we have the genius to discover this, it can mean great prosperity. But of course, prosperity is largely, first of all, an attitude of mind. Mike Todd, the TV and motion picture producer, you know, said, "I have often been penniless. I have never been poor. I have often been penniless. I've never been poor." And you all know the story, of course, about Thomas Edison, who was, as you may remember from the stories, hard of hearing. And one night, his West Orange, New Jersey laboratories caught on fire, and one of his aides came to his bedside and roused him from slumber and shouted into his deaf ears that the work of his lifetime was going up in flames. And he said, "Oh, thank you for telling me. We'll build some new ones in the morning." Nobody could take away the real wealth of that man, which was not simply the things in the laboratories, but the mind, the genius, the inspiration within him that produced those things. And he hadn't lost contact with that. Lloyd C. Douglas wrote a book called White Banners. You may have read it. You probably read Green Light and The Robe and Magnificent Obsession. White Banners didn't get much publicity some way, and yet it has some wonderful points in it. To make it as brief as possible, a college professor who had a small and growing family and was very ambitious for their happy future was quite an inventor. And he invented something, I don't remember now what it was, but it was something that was negotiable and useful. And a friend of his stole it away from him. And he was so disheartened, discouraged, he decided that if you couldn't even trust a close friend, what could you trust? And there was a woman in impoverished circumstances who came to the house for a moment of shelter in a heavy storm, found the professor's wife with a babe in arms, and the child was ill, and the mother was frantic with trying to keep all the work done. She just volunteered to stay there and take care of the situation until it eased. And it was she, Hannah, who discovered how sad the young professor was and said, "Well, if your invention had not been stolen, would you have stopped inventing? You wouldn't have stopped there, would you?" And he said, "Oh, no, I had many dreams and plans." She said, "Then don't run up the white flag of defeat. Run up the white banners of victory and go ahead and develop these other inventions," which he did. A simple story. But Lloyd C. Douglas had a way of telling these things. I have been with him a number of times, and it brings to mind amusing stories about him. He was in his 70s when I first knew him, and he had a great sense of humor, or rather droll wit, and exchanged many amusing stories with me, and some serious things, too. At the time, I was busy on a book. And he said, "Ernest, if you want to write a book that will be a bestseller, I said, oh yes, I would like that very much. He said, write a book about Jesus. Write a book about Jesus. He's the greatest character in history, the most dramatic one, the one that people ought to know more about than anything else. And that's been a dream in my heart for a long time, that I should do so, but I can hardly write anything and leave him out. Well, all these things suggest to us that the real source of prosperity is not money. Money is a symbol of the exchange of things. We don't have to carry around big cartwheels of stone like our ancient ancestors did, or several dozen eggs in order to exchange them for something else. And so currency is much more convenient. But this is only a symbol of God's bountiful supply. And coin, ideas are coin of the mind realm. Ideas are coin of the mind realm. This was Thomas Edison's richness. It's everybody's wealth. Ideas. If you can give someone a helpful idea, like Ella Wheeler Wilcox wrote about here, I gave a thought, and through that thought of mine, he found himself a man divine. Find some way to reach out beyond your own individual life experience, and you open channels of supply from other people. The poor man, we have a notation, is the shut-in man. So give as you receive. And there are several actions of the giving process. Are you one of the people who is saved from disaster at the 59th second or the last minute of the hour? Many people live that way, kind of on the edges of things, you know. I sometimes wonder if that is part of a pattern that people establish. People vary about this. You know, some people are always late to most anything. We have quite a few of them at Unity on the Plaza in Kansas City. It isn't the ones who live the farthest away, usually. It may be somebody who lives across the street. More likely to be late, the 5 minutes late one. And there's some people that no matter where they live, how far they have to go, are always a little ahead of time. There's some people who are slow answering letters, some slow paying bills, not perhaps because they don't have the money to do it, but they just hate to do it until they have to. So they wait till the last day that they can get a discount on it, or the last day before interest is charged on it. I wonder if such people are not establishing a pattern in their life, as if infinite intelligence, the creative principle, might say, oh, so that's what you like in life, is it? All right, as you do, so shall it be done unto you. As you sow, so shall you reap. You are making the pattern. God doesn't make a pattern of last-minute rescue, I don't think, but sometimes we do make it for ourselves. So one of the things by which we can increase our supply is whatever we're going to give, give it promptly. And give it, yes, let's just mention that first. Give it promptly. And even when you cannot see that it will do any good. Some of you probably have read a little book called That Something, about a man who was down on his luck, and he spent the night in jail because there was nowhere else to go. And finally, against his will, he accosted a man on the street and asked for a handout. And this man said, well, what will you do if I give it to you? He said, well, I'll get some food. And he said, what next? He said, well, I'll spend the night in jail again because I have nowhere else to go. So he gave him a small sum, but he said, I can't do much for you until you find that something. And the story of the little book is how this man found that something, and how these two men who met on the street found each other, incidentally. In the book, Every Good Desire, you'll find a restatement of the law of the magic lamp. which, as you recall, involved a genie that appeared when a young man polished the lamp, which was tarnished and old, and the genie gave him a wish in exchange for the good work he had done. Then he tried to get the genie to appear by rubbing the lamp, but his purpose was different, and the genie wouldn't appear until he did it for a good purpose of improving the lamp. In my Cleveland ministry, a good many years ago now, there was a man who came to me in great despair. I think the story of this is told in the Sunlit Way. He was discharged from a job in which he had served for 20 years, and he was considering jumping off the high-level bridge in Cleveland because of this. He was so discouraged, disappointed, felt so abused, unappreciated. So I said, well, did you like the job you had when you had it? Well, no, he hadn't. Was the income great? Well, it wasn't as much as he deserved. And I said, well, then I don't think you should have had that job. It's a good thing that you have been discharged from it. And you need to start over again. He said, well, I owe a lot of debts, and I don't know how to pay them. He said, I'm thinking about going into bankruptcy before I jump off the bridge. So I said, well, before you do either one, why don't you have a meeting with your creditors and tell them what the situation is and see if they won't help you? Well, they not only helped him to get a new job, but they arranged to take small sums over a long period of time so that he did pay all his bills and he did get another job and he didn't jump off the high-level bridge. Do all that you can do, and before you reach the last thing you can do, God will come to your aid. Do all you can do before you reach the last thing you can do, and God will come to your aid. And the deliverance often takes surprising forms. I told you, I think, about how I used to go sometimes and stand before a reproduction of the praying hands and meditate on things for which I was seeking an answer. And I came up with the thought, if I have enough on deposit in God's bank of good, he will honor my check of need. And if not, and I'm overdrawn, then I better find it out now and start over. Well, he's always honored my checks of need, somehow or other, often in ways that I couldn't foresee. Well, another step about giving, to give freely. Do you like to have gifts given to you with strings attached?
No.
No, most of us don't. We don't like Indian givers. We don't like really for people to give us something with any kind of obligation attached. It is so much pleasanter if somebody gives you something just because he wants to and because it's his nature to do it. So that many people are very suspicious about gifts because they look to see where the price tag is. So we have a little slogan for that in Unity 2, very simple. What I give, I give. What I give, I give. We used to have a motto lying in burnt wood by a little offering basket in the door of the church I served. It said, what I give, I have. What I keep, I lose. A little boy came to church with his grandmother, and she gave him a coin to put in this basket. She wanted him to understand the law of giving. And he stood there and he looked at that and he said, what I give, I have. What I keep, I lose. Tis that way with me. And put the coin back in his pocket. then they're the kind of people, you know, who give until it hurts, and they want you to know how much it hurts. Self-sacrificing people. I've talked with many self-sacrificing people. They're the people who have no flesh. They've been worked down to the bone. I've worked my fingers to the bone, they'll tell you, for an unappreciative husband, an unappreciative wife, an unappreciative son or daughter or friend or relative. And you pay dearly for that kind of giving, and it isn't really giving, is it? It has such a very large string, almost a rope attached, that binds you under. People who sacrifice for others. I knew a woman once who tried to do something good and got rheumatism for it. Her mother-in-law came to visit with her, and her mother-in-law liked a sunny room. So she gave up her sunny room for her mother-in-law, and she took the one in which the sun never shone, and she got rheumatism for it. But I don't think it was because the sun wasn't shining in the room. I think it was a body protest against that negative idea about giving, that she wasn't really giving willingly or happily at all. She was giving because she felt she just had to, because it was a mother-in-law. Another one is to give positively. Don't give grudgingly, for as the Bible tells us, the Lord loves a cheerful giver. The Lord loves a cheerful giver. Be definite in your giving. When you are the anvil, stand, and when you are the hammer, strike. The author of that is Edwin Markham, who is an old-time friend of Unity's, and in that past incarnation I spoke, he visited Unity down on Tracy, and many of us got well acquainted with him. Another droll character, unselfish, loving, kindly man. Give positively, give regularly as you wish God to give to you. We can survive most any time of stringency because we're very durable, we human beings, but it's much pleasanter if we don't have to go through times of stringency. And in that, too, I think we sort of set patterns. We set patterns for ourselves. And it's very interesting to study and see what kind of patterns we set in our own life. I knew someone else who had set a pattern in her life. When she bought a new car, which was frequently, she always seemed to get a lemon. That's what they called the car that was remiss or imperfect in some way. And she must have gotten some of those Monday cars that the book Wheels tells you you never should buy. You should never buy any car that's been put together before Wednesday, because the workmen haven't overcome their weekend dissipations to be sure to get all the nuts and bolts right. I just learned that recently. We know too much about the wrong thing sometimes, don't we? And of course, the final thing about just this aspect of giving is to give because it is God-like to give. Give because it's God-like to give, and because God gives so much to you. And must I keep giving again and again? Oh no, said the angel, his glance pierced me through. Just give till the Master stops giving to you. We all live on borrowed time. Everything we have is a gift to us from nature, it seemed like. Even the clothes we wear. The animals are provided with theirs as they're born and growing, but we have to borrow ours from the rest of nature. And so the law of giving and the law of receiving is a very big part of our individual life. What you give, you have. What you keep, you lose. Is really true, even though that little boy didn't know it. And then to hold the good you have easily without fear of loss. And even if there is loss the loss will be repaid. I will restore unto thee the years the locust hath eaten, we read in the book of Joel. And many of us have had reason to know that and to prove it, and to know that no door closes, but another opens, which is a trite remark, and you've heard it many times, but it's trite because it's true. Most people, when they are facing some apparent loss, are looking backward, you see, and they need to turn around and look the other way and see what is awaiting them, because nature abhors a vacuum, and if your life becomes empty in one regard, it will be filled in another. But it's very important how it is filled, too. What's that story in the Bible about the house that had a devil and somebody evicted it but left the door open, seven others came in? It's important to close the door against negation and to be open to that which is constructive. Another way of putting it is the way we spoke about it either last night, or I mean last lesson, or the time before, that we need to be positive against all that is beneath us, that is, unworthy of us, receptive to all that is above, and to know that God's supply is constant. Do you ever think you're going to run out of ideas if your work demands ideas? Nobody can place a limit on the number of ideas that are available to man. You'd think that all the ideas for Christmas cards had been worked out long ago, wouldn't you, when you think how many millions of them are produced every year. And yet every year I get stacks of them that are unlike any I've ever seen before. You'd think that all the tunes that could ever be composed of those 12 half tones of the musical scale would have been written by now. And yet we continue to come up with variations on the old ones, or some that seem completely new. Of course, I don't suppose they can be completely new. I guess nothing really is. Which reminds me of another story. This one's about reincarnation indirectly. But it was about my secretary, who's a grandmother. Maybe I've told you this. And she was more or less apologizing because she was so much older than he in regard to the things that he as a small boy liked. And he looked up at her kind of wistfully, and he said, "Well, Grandma, none of us is new." None of us is new. He was probably an old soul and had reason to believe that. But whether we are or not, and no matter how many times we have seen the operation of this law of giving and receiving and prosperity, we have to renew our realization of it continually, and we can't live very long by the things of the past. We have to keep renewing our faith, renewing our compliance with the law. We have to keep giving. We can't just say, "Well, I gave a lot last year to so-and-so and such," because last year is gone. What are you doing today? And we want to receive from life abundantly in the present, so we have to give in the present too. And even in the time of Moses, you know, when he was leading the Israelites through the wilderness, and they had to be awfully stubborn, the negative people, for it to take so long. You could go across that area in 2 days, I think, really. But it took 40 years before they could get over their old ideas and be open and receptive to some new ones. And they kept thinking about how even when they had to make bricks without straw, at least they had the bricks and the straw, and here we were in the desert, what do we now do now? And Moses assured them that God will provide. And so there was this little substance that appeared on the surface of the ground called manna. Been a great question of what that really was. My friend Dr. Lamza tells me it was a little plant growth, but that it wouldn't keep long. You had to gather it fresh every day. So whether one explanation is better than another about the nature of manna, the principle that's involved there and that the Israelites need to know is that you have to gather your faith fresh every morning too. We have to gather our faith and our persistence and all the strong constructive qualities of our nature every day, and take no thought of the moral, no negative thought of it. Center thought in today. Learn from yesterday, prepare for tomorrow, and live today. Learn from the past, prepare for the future, and live in the now. There's no subject that we can deal with that can help and bless us more than the right idea about prosperity, because prosperity and health or well-being are the same thing, really, and sometimes we can approach it more easily from the prosperity angle than from the health angle. If you heard people say, oh, I never have any trouble demonstrating prosperity, but I do have health problems. Then someone else will say, oh, I never have any health problems, but it's prosperity that I have difficulty with. And yet the two things are the same. You might say that prosperity is health and finances, and just the opposite, that the two are interchangeable. And when you work for one, you can include the other, because the law, or the principle, is the same. There is a law of equivalence between what we conceive and what we bring forth. Remember the story about Jacob and Laban and the spotted sticks. What you see, that you will think. What you think, that you will conceive. What you conceive, that you will bring forth. And so a way of seeing is very important. It's a part of this law of prosperity that is especially significant right at this time in the world, because we're all called upon to make our decisions about the way we see things. Either this is the last days of prophecy that you read about in the 24th chapter, I think it is, of Matthew, or else it's the beginning of a new age, and quite possibly it's both. But which are you going to dwell on? Are you going to dwell on all the aspects of the violence of the old dying age? Or are you going to think, well, now this is clearing the way for the new ages to come? Whenever we're approaching a strong change in our life cycles individually or as a nation or as mankind, there always are these upheavals in the larger sense in the world, upheavals sometimes in our own individual life experiences. And we have to then deal with these things in a constructive way so that we're not overwhelmed by them, and so that we know that God's law always works, that it's always the same, the appearances change, and we're often carried away by them, overcome by them for a time, so that we make things very difficult for ourselves and often for other people too. And yet the principle is the same, even when we don't understand its action. We have to take the attitude that I told you about, of the young man who was so violently ill and had hallucinations, and who said to his mother, I know these things are not so, but this is the way they appear. And in the face of adverse appearances, we have to take the same attitude, a strong affirmative attitude, and to build in consciousness a strong sense of security and supply. Now, I don't know any other way to do this except by actually putting it into practice in our lives. Someone said to me the other day, just recently, well, your lessons are so simple that even a child can understand them. And I said, well, that's great. If they're that simple, then nobody should have any trouble in applying them and doing them. But they're no good unless you do apply them. But if you do, they will work. They will work if you apply them. And that's something that many Unity students still need to find out, that they feel like having a certificate on the wall, a diploma, or a statement that they finished Lessons in Truth, or taken some course or other, or read certain books, is going to be their salvation. But not unless these things are applied. I'd like to think that some of my books would survive for a while, but I can't really feel that they're great literature to deserve that kind of recognition of lasting very long, maybe. But they are primarily books of instruction, not to be read just as fast as you can to get through to the last page, but to be read until you come to something to do, and then stop and do it. Stop and do it right there. Put it to practice and see how it works. Prove for yourself that it works. And that's the most practical advice about prosperity that I know. Try giving yourself away. Try doing things for other people without thought of return, which is one of the cardinal principles. There was a man years ago who liked to do that. And he would write letters to editors and send them slogans and things for business firms. And one time he was in a town, I don't remember the name of it, where the 20th Century Limited train was going east and another one was coming west. And they met, not on the same track, of course, in this little town. And he sent, he thought this was quite significant, and he sent a motto to the management of the 20th Century Railway. Where the centuries pass, where the centuries pass. He did it because he thought it was a winsome idea, an attractive one. He didn't expect any return for it. But because he had offered it without price, they were especially grateful for it and sent him a lifetime pass on the railway. Often, you know, our good comes in unexpected ways, and it comes best when we're not really looking for it, but when we're just doing something because it's a good thing to do. See, this is based on the principle that we've talked about and will more, because it's very important. A friend of mine, Walter Starkey, who wrote the book This Double Thread, in a talk he gave for us at Unity on the Plaza a while ago, startled people by saying, there is no cause in effects. There is no cause in effects. Many of the people who were attending the meeting thought he said, there is no cause and effects. But what he really said was not A-N-D, but I-N. There is no cause in effects. And what we really are trying to do in our study of unity is to work with causes and let effects take care of themselves. If you're working for effects, you may get clear off the track. It's like a person who tries to look healthy by paint or makeup and so on, when the only real health, it comes from within, isn't it? Well, that's a poor illustration, maybe. Or you could say it's like a person who is not very strong but takes a pompous attitude, as weakness often will disguise or masquerade as strength. Sometimes men of small stature will wear high heels and other things to look impressive, epaulettes maybe on the shoulders or something, any kind of uniform to be impressive, to claim a strength that in a person's own heart he doesn't feel, or he wouldn't need to use such artifices. So that more and more as we learn actually to apply the teachings of unity, we realize that what is most effective is working on causes, and that causes start in the invisible. The causes start in the invisible. Ideas are coin of the mind realm, and all wealth and bounty comes from within out. By the use of outward things, yes, but by the ingenuity that comes from within, that increases the value of that which is obvious, or recognizes the value. Someone has said, I believe it was Glenn Clark, I think, who said that weeds are plants for which man has not yet discovered the use. Weeds are simply plants for which man has not yet discovered the use. And then somebody like George Washington Carver comes along, we mention him, and others who have discovered wealth through simple, limited things. And of course, we now know that one of the greatest powers in the world on the physical plane is in the atom, which is about as small a thing as you can get, and yet which is endued with so much power, as we say, from on high. So that when we really set to work on the law of giving, we are touching the creative aspect of mind, inviting the flow of ideas from on high. Now, there are many ways that we can do this. A writer, for instance, who maybe gives all his lifetime to writing, may very well feel he's come to the end of his rope, nothing more to say, until he takes two apparently unrelated ideas and links them. And then he takes a third idea and links that. And then another, and he weaves another triangle. And the first thing you know, he is weaving a net of ideas, a net of circumstance, of cause and effect, one, two, three, four, and so on. And there is no limit to the creative principle, the creative ideas in mind that are man's great resource and his deliverance. There is a principle in us that people give many names to. We've talked about it and will. I call it the knower sometimes. Some people call it the subconscious, the subliminal, the innate. One of my friends who is a chiropractor always talks about the innate. But whatever name you give it, it is that creative principle within us that is the healing power in the body, that is the restorative power of inspiration, that will bring you new ideas which come when you become relaxed and enter into a listening state of mind. You remember the story about Elijah, who was so distressed about Jezebel and her goings-on, and how he appeared in her court and hurled imprecations at her, and this aroused her naturally ebullient nature, and she ordered her warriors to pursue him with spears, and he fled out into the desert ahead of them. They were in chariots, and he fled on foot, but he outran them some way or other. That must have been by divine guidance, I think, too. And out in the desert, he stopped to rest and think over his sorry state, and we're told that he was fed by ravens. Did you raise an eyebrow at that remark, that he was fed by ravens in the desert? You know what it really was? It was Arabians. Arabians. And two words are almost the same in the original language. And it was even a greater miracle that the Arabians would feed him, a Semitic man, a Jew, than if the ravens had done so. And then he climbed up Mount Sinai, and he was still full of, like Paul later on, full of threatenings and slaughter. And he ascended to the top of the mountains, and the storms raged about him. The earth quaked, the thunder roared, the lightning flashed, the rain fell in torrents, the wind swirled about him and beat against him. And he couldn't find God in any of these things. And then finally all the storms abated, and he heard a still small voice that told him not to be discouraged, not to give up, that God would be with him, and he'd find his fulfillment. Well, of course he did. And you and I might well suspect that the quakings and the raging and the upsetment of the elements was basically in Elijah. He was full of all these things, and when he settled down, came into his right mind again, the storms quieted, and he heard the still small voice. But you have to develop the discipline of listening for that still small voice of guidance that can open ways of prosperity before you. Ways that wouldn't be right for anybody else, maybe, but would be for you. They may lead you into strange paths, or it may, this voice, and yet it will see you through if you work from that inner guidance. How can you tell a difference? Well, the difference, that is, of course, between guidance from within and impressions from outside. Well, the impressions from outside and their influence on you will change with expediency. You change them easily if they don't seem to be right, but you can't argue with that still small voice. You may try to, and you may go against it, but it will not change. It will stay the same, steadfast, and I've had this experience more than once. I didn't always learn it the first time, and I had to learn it over again. I would say, oh, that can't be right. It must be that God meant thus and so. Like a woman who wanted me to pray for her son not to have to go to jail because of some infractions of the law. And I said, well, dear, let me pray that whatever is for his highest good will happen to him. Oh, it's conceivable, maybe inconceivable to you that ever going to jail would be for the highest good, but it might have checked the tendency this youth had of being disobedient and regardless of other people's rights and so on. And finally, he did get into worse trouble. She said, well, if you won't pray that way, I'll get someone else to pray. So she did, and he didn't go to jail that time, but finally he was accused of murder and had to go through that trial and experience. And it might have been better, but you don't have to pray for outcomes, because see, then you're getting onto the pattern of effects instead of causes, of results instead of the origin, the creative principle that brings the result. There is no cause in effects, you see. So don't be too worried about the effects. Think of causes. Go back to first principles. If someone is very ill and wants your prayers, how are you going to pray for him? How can you pray for him? Maybe he is in extremity. Are you going to pray that he remains in the body? That's what most people want you to do. I find that I can't even do that, even though I'm told and I can believe that God's will for man is to be well. But if he can't be well in the body, maybe it would be better for him to make another start. And so not knowing, not having that kind of insight, when someone asks me to pray that way, I pray for freedom. For freedom in whatever way is best in God's sight. Getting back to the principle. Not with the results, not with appearances, but with causation. You can pray for freedom then in whatever way in God's sight is best, you see. Leave it with God. Let God be in charge. Stick to principle, work from cause, and it is God's will that we shall prosper, and it's demonstrable. Well, you know, it's time for us to pause now for questions. First one I come to is, how can I overcome my timidity and get started doing God's work? Well, the only way I know is to face it, to face your timidity. That's what I've had to do. I think I told you about how I tried to give a sermon for the first time in a little church, and I had stage fright so bad that my stomach got upset and I had to leave the chancel and lose my breakfast, and then I came back and finished the talk. I bet you haven't gone that far yet. And everybody is timid about some things. That doesn't mean you're cowardly necessarily. There's a story out of World War I, which many of you couldn't remember that far back or know about it, but a young a soldier turned to an older one when they had to advance, and he turned to him and said, "Oh, I'm afraid." And the older man said, "Well, how do you suppose the rest of us feel?" There are things that naturally we should be afraid of, and maybe the thing we should be most afraid of is not to live up to what our capacity is, and thereby lose a lot of the potential that we have. What are Unity's views on premarital sex? Well, and is it wrong? Well, how do you feel about it? You're the one that asked the question, and so you have an intelligence in you that is your own monitor and your own guide. I might just as well read, "What are Unity's views on postmarital sex?" as well as premarital. It isn't so much a matter of pre or post, I don't think, as it is whether this is simply a physical gratification or a natural expression of a deep inward spiritual affection. And it's that more than anything else, I think, would make, seem to me, that would make the difference. I haven't really asked God about this. I don't have occasion to particularly, but if you do, do it. Ask for guidance about it. How is joy best released when it seems to be stuck? Does joy get stuck? Joy is an inside job, like happiness, and it isn't primarily dependent on what is happening outside, but how you feel about it. Some of the happiest, most smiling faces I've seen have been with little children who were afflicted and were in a hospital, maybe fastened to a board or something, and yet the most radiant, smiling faces you ever had. And there's a great lesson in this for somebody, for anybody like me, for instance, to go there and see this. It makes me feel apologetic that I ever am irritated or disappointed about some outward condition that I think should be better than it is. Is it necessary to give your tithe to a church? No. Of course, the church would like to have it, and the church probably needs it. But no, let's see, it goes on. We are to tithe to God. Does this mean we are to give to any good cause? Well, the way I interpret tithing is that it is a gift to God's work. There are all kinds of charities, and I don't think of charity and tithe as being the same thing. I think of tithes as being supplementing what needs to be done that is not done for material reasons. There are all sorts of charities. It isn't hard to raise large sums for them, and it isn't hard to get large sums of money for very material things. It's easy to get $1 million for a prize fight, to promote a prize fight. It isn't nearly as easy to get $1 million for a church or for a spiritual cause, and yet the one is transient and the other may be for eternity. I have been a member of your congregation for almost a year and have never heard anything about finances. This has appeal for me, but I am curious why stewardship is never mentioned. postscript, I'm glad it hasn't been. Well, bless you. We're glad that you're glad about that. And it isn't that we don't need finances, but we don't make direct appeals for them. Everybody knows the church has to be supported, and we pass the offering basket, but nobody in the church has ever approached and said, will you give so much money for any cause? Sometimes we tell people, because they ask us, what our projects are. Especially people come to me about that, and they say, Ernest, what projects are underway at the church now? And I never have much trouble telling them, because there's always something that's needed. Some of the things aren't very dramatic and don't make much appeal. It's much easier to sell people the idea of helping to floodlight the church from the outside, or to renew the artistic planting around the church. But you tell them that you need a new boiler for the furnace, and it doesn't seem somehow to strike that inspirational chord. I had my first great experience with this in Los Angeles when I started to work cold out there back in 1938, and I had to borrow ushers from other churches and rent an auditorium, and the rent cost more than the offerings that came in for a while, and the whole thing was done on faith. In 4 years' time, we outgrew the auditorium that we paid rent on. It seated 1,294 people, and we outgrew it, and we were looking around for a place. We found an adequate building that had been a Jewish Reformed temple, and they had overbuilt, and it had reverted to the financing company that had underwritten it. And the Jewish congregation, by the way, was not bereft. They built a new church out in Beverly Hills that was better than the old one that they lost. But we couldn't build at that time. It was right after Pearl Harbor, and an attorney who had helped me in some respects said, well, Los Angeles is likely to be bombed or even invaded. And he was very shocked when we told him that we had bought this church building and agreed to pay for it in 20 years. And we never made any more solicitation for funds than whoever wrote this question has asked yet. We paid for the church in less than 2 years. And so I knew then that we were on the right track and that we were putting the right things first, and that we were dwelling on causes enough so that results would take care of themselves. Now we're up against and in the same experience in Unity Temple in Kansas City, which now is 26 years old, and there are lots of things that need to be replaced and so on, and the same law of supply is working. I know a person who tithes, pays bills promptly, blesses and forgives his debtors, gives himself away, still their prosperity arrives at the 59th minute of the 11th hour. Would you comment on the possible reasons for this? I would say that basically the law of as you give, so shall you receive must be working. And if you don't see it that way and it appears to contradict, I know it's only an appearance, because that is the principle, and if you keep at it, it will work. There's another matter there that I haven't taken up in this class, another subject, and that is a matter of reincarnation and karma, both good and bad. And I don't mean necessarily good and bad literally, but that's the way people think of it. Because as you sow, so shall you reap. And if you have a lesson to learn and you haven't learned it in one lifetime, it's only fair that you'd have a chance to come back and really learn it a second time. If you send a child to school and he doesn't learn his lessons, what are you going to do? Let him stay out of school? No, he goes back to school. And if necessary, he takes the same grade over again, the same term over again, until he has learned it. Because the important thing is to learn. It isn't even what grades you get or how important you feel, or whether you demonstrate the law. You're always demonstrating some law. But back of that, there may be a hidden factor that I haven't touched on, and that's as much as I can say. I was born into a parentage where the emphasis was on pinching pennies. I married a man who was afraid there would not be sufficient supply. He passed on, and I'm remarried now to a man who fears poverty in coming in retirement. I want to rise above this repetitiveness. Could you suggest some thoughts I may hold in mind to bring about a change in this pattern? I sincerely want to claim the good that is mine in all its aspects. All right? Who is your provider? Is it the husband?
No.
He's a channel. He may be a channel, but isn't God the real provider? Okay. Well, that's where I believe you might find it helpful to work, to take the thought like this. God is my instant, constant, and abundant supply of all good. God is my instant, constant, and abundant supply. It may not sound right to you now, but say it over a few times, and I think it will improve. How do you explain God's hand in the recent abduction of a 13-year-old girl in the vicinity of Prairie Village swimming pool? Well, I don't know whether I'm supposed to, but I'll try. There are many adverse things of this character that take place in the world, and what I have to say about them does not excuse anybody from the wrongdoing. You remember the Bible says, stumbling must come, but woe to him by whom it cometh. And this is not to be heartless about the 13-year-old girl. I wouldn't want that to happen to anybody of any age. And we say, well, an innocent child of 13, which it would be true in human sense, but you know, there's no age in our identity. Souls that are newborn into the world are not necessarily new souls. They are souls coming into new bodies and young bodies. This child is young. It may possibly even be that in a past life she had committed something like this and needed to find out what it would be like. And sometimes the only way we can know is by the pain that we ourselves experience. How are we going to know how we hurt someone else unless we feel a hurt somewhere? So I suppose that's the law of reincarnation. Also, I think on occasion, I don't think about this, but I thought this about the Lindbergh baby, you know, that tragic story, and my friend Adela Rogers St. John has written about it extensively in her book Honeycomb, and of course there have been many other things written about it. But I've often wondered if maybe that infant was a soul who was courageous enough to come in willing to undergo that experience to change the laws of a nation about kidnapping and so on. Does Jesus have any teachings on reincarnation? Oh, yes. There are quite a number of them in the New Testament. Did I mention in this class about my 25 questions and the Bible references? Well, then briefly, I would say that there are a number of instances in which Jesus, not using the term reincarnation, but referred to that principle. The principle of resurrection is another form of reincarnation, and the words have been used interchangeably and were in Bible times, but there are more direct references. The one where Peter comes to Jesus, Simon Peter, you know, if he were living today, you know what his name would be? Simon Johnson, because he was Simon Bar-Jonah. And Bar-Jonah means son of Jonah, and Jonah is the same word as John. So he was Simon, son of John, Simon Johnson. But Jesus gave him a new name, Peter, which means a rock. It also means a dull fellow. And I think Jesus is making a little pun about Peter, because at times he was a pretty dull fellow. But even though he made a lot of mistakes, he didn't stop there, and he went on until he could make successes of things that he'd failed at previously. And so he comes to Jesus and says, Master, you know, people are talking about you. And Jesus said, what are they saying? Well, they've been speculating on who you've been in past lives, whether you were Jeremiah or Elijah or one of the other prophets. And Jesus didn't deny this. He did on another occasion say, when they said that Elijah must first come before the prophet, before the great prophet, Messiah. And he said, well, Elijah's already come, and they did with him as they would. And that, I believe, was a reference to John the Baptist, who had been beheaded, remember? And he was a cousin on the human plane of Jesus as a human man. Then there was the... Jesus said to Simon Peter, but who do you say I am? And Jesus, or Simon Peter, in a moment of clear realization, said, well, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, well, flesh and blood have not revealed that to you, Peter, but my Father which is in heaven. Then there was another case where a man, I mentioned this, I'm sure, a man who was born blind, and they said, who sinned, this man or his parents? Yes, we went over that. Since unity teaches that we are to spread the word of truth, how can this be reconciled with the Bible admonition? Do not cast pearls before swine, lest they turn again to rend you. Well, there's an occasion when most everything that we say is true and when the opposite is true. There's a time to be still and a time to speak. There's a time to sow and a time to reap. On some occasions, and several, in fact, Jesus said, tell no man. By the way, I mentioned Abelardo St. John. She's written a novel called Tell No Man. I overlooked one question here along with the one about Jesus and reincarnation. Do you personally feel you recognize people you knew from previous lifetimes? Yes, I do, every once in a while. And it's like meeting an old friend. It's a delightful experience. Your manner is so calm, soothing, that it makes the profound truths you speak easier to comprehend. Well, thank you. If I seem calm or even soothing, let me confess that it hasn't always been that way. But I used to have quite a temper, and I found that indulging it was too expensive. It made me ill for a couple of days to go on a good rampage of a violent feeling. And then maybe not even remember in a few days what I had been angry about, you know. It's very, very belittling in some way. So I've worked at that quite a little bit because I don't find very many things that are worth it. A little while ago, one of our more aggressive ladies in the church and her husband took me to dine somewhere with them and took that opportunity to tell me about something that they thought was very much amiss and should be corrected. And I said, well, dear, I just don't believe I can be upset about that. And this lady said, well, I think I'd like it better if you could. Well, it wasn't that I couldn't, really, but that I preferred not to be. Have you written a book on reincarnation? Thank you, I love you. Well, thanks for that part. Yes, I have written two books on reincarnation, both of them now out of print, and I'm working on another one. The one published by Unity back about 1935 was called Have We Lived Before? Then Prentice Hall in New York asked me to write a book after the Bridie Murphy affair about reincarnation, and I wrote one for them, and I sent them 20 parts of possible titles for it, and they didn't choose any of them. One of the ones I thought would be nice would be Many Happy Returns. But they didn't think so, and they ended up trying to copy the original book that I'd done, and making as near as they could by, have you lived other lives, which is kind of awkward. But you might find either of those books in a secondhand bookstore. I sometimes run across some of my best writing that way. In regard to Paul's thorn in the side, how is this explained metaphysically, and why was a healing not affected? Well, I can only surmise, of course. You know, most everybody has something that's a thorn in the side. That would be one way to describe whatever's the matter with you. And usually whatever's the matter with you is a whoever is the matter with you. Because so often it's a who instead of a what that seems to be the matter with us. And coming right back to principle, it's something in ourselves, you see, that's the matter. And something that we haven't worked out yet can be like a thorn in the side. Maybe that's oversimplifying, and I don't mean to be unfeeling about people's physical problems. I've had mine too, and still do at times. But metaphysically, what was a thorn in the side to Paul can be whatever it is that you're working on and haven't successfully met or conquered or found the right constructive use for it. And thorn needs to be pulled out and healing take place. Would you give us your definition of agape? I don't have any special one, just the regular dictionary one. And I cultivate the dictionary habit. Whenever you're reading a Unity book and doing your studies, have a dictionary at hand and know what you're writing and how to spell it and what it means. Well, here's the little typewritten one I told you about. What do you think about the following? The renewal taking place in Orthodox churches regarding the gifts of the Spirit. Well, I'm all for it. I approve of it thoroughly, and I'm glad that they are. And it takes some kind of peculiar forms at times, but if the sense of values and the sense of direction is right, the outcome will be good. I don't find myself too sympathetic to speaking in tongues, for instance. I think it's misunderstood often, but if other people get good out of it, fine for them. The charismatic movement, speaking in tongues is right there. I've already answered it. The Jesus people, well, quite a few years ago now, remember when Jesus Christ Superstar came out? It was presented here in Kansas City, down in our municipal auditorium. It was wonderful, except the music was so loud that I could hardly hear for a day or two afterwards. Now, I was sitting down in the second row, which to explain it, and after it, a reporter on one of the national magazines asked me what I thought of it, whether I approved of it, and I said, I approve anything that makes young people or older people, either for that matter, think about Jesus Christ, because if they think enough about him, they'll come to some real good answers, and I might not choose just the same way of ending the story as they did in it, but there's so much good in it, I approve that. About the second coming of Jesus, and I have a question or have had somewhere whether I believe that Jesus will come again out of the clouds as he disappeared in them. Yes. His nature will, whether it will be Jesus in person or that spirit which we identified as the Christ and saw through him, that is coming into it is a second coming in that respect. The clouds are referred to in Acts 1:11, referring to this passage, have to do with that, and I think it means the clouds of misunderstanding, the clouds of confusion, and cloudy thinking. You see, there is spiritual smog in the world as well as physical smog. And Los Angeles hasn't a corner on it. It has a lot of it there, but it's not the only place. It shall come to pass in the latter days, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. We quoted this in the lesson too. Ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing into heaven? This same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as you've seen him go into heaven. Well, I hope I've given a thought that will be helpful to you on that. This is not a question, I find. So that's the last question I have for tonight.